and welcome in to a special Christmas Eve edition of True Crime Tuesday. I'm Tim Dennison for Dave Schrader. It's an encore presentation, and you know, one of the most popular movies of 2019 is The Irishman with Al Pacino, Robert De Niro, Joe Pesci, and it's based on a book that we actually talked about back in August 29th of 2017. And it's I Hear You Paint Houses by Charles Brandt. It's an interesting book in that it dealt with Jimmy Hoffa and Crazy Joe Gallo and JFK in a case that dealt with those three characters. And well, I won't spoil the movie for you, but it was a very interesting case, to say the least. Now, the movie is very vague. It doesn't go into the ending, so to speak, and I won't spoil the movie for you at all there, but Charles Brandt does go into detail in his interview with us as to what he believes the fate of Jimmy Hoffa was. And it's a very interesting interview at that. So we'll get to that here as well. One other note about this interview. At the end of the interview, it says that the Irishman was going to come out in 2018. Now, interestingly enough, I was watching an interview with Robert De Niro where he said he first picked up Charles Brandt's book in 2007, read it from cover to cover, was enamored with it, wrote the date that he read the book in the front of the book, and then put the book away, and then picked the book up again, got a hold of Marty Scorsese and said, "Marty, we got to make this movie." And then put it away again. And then picked it up again and said, insisted to Marty Scorsese, "We got to make this movie." Finally, they got it nailed down and made. And here we are in 2019, 12 years later, and the project is made. Now, when we did the interview, again, in August of 2017, they said the movie was coming in 2018, definitely 2018, even with production delays and special effects, because they did the de-aging process, which took extra time. It took a whole nother year for that movie to come out. Think about that for a second. 12 years of hard work and badgering and pushing forward to get this movie made. It tells you it's something special, and the movie really is something special. You have to see it if you haven't seen it yet. And it's up for many, many different awards. Again, I won't take up much more of your time here, but it's our special Christmas Eve encore presentation. We'll call it The Irishman. We originally called this A Hitman Speaks, Closing the Case on Hoffa and JFK. We're calling it The Irishman, and here it is. Here's Charles Brandt on an encore presentation of True Crime Tuesday.
Hello and welcome. It's time to tune in to a brand new episode of True Crime Tuesday. I'm your host, Dave Schrader, along with me, Tim Dennis. We've got some dumb crimes and stupid criminals lined up for you a little later on in the show, but joining us for the beginning of the show, Charles Brandt. He's the author of numerous best-selling true crime novels based on the major crimes that Brandt himself solved through interrogation during his illustrious legal career as a homicide investigator, prosecutor, and eventually the chief deputy attorney general of the state of Delaware. His book, I Heard You Paint Paint Houses, a number one New York Times bestseller published in over 14 countries, is the definitive work solving the disappearance and murder of Teamsters boss Jimmy Hoffa. It's the biography of a colorful hitman, Frank the Irishman Sheeran, and he's the prime suspect in the FBI's Jimmy Hoffa case. Brandt's book is based on nearly 5 years of interviews he recorded on tapes that have since been subpoenaed by the FBI. As a matter of fact, the Martin Scorsese film based on I Heard You Paint Houses will be a major motion picture released by Paramount, I believe, next year, 2018. The blockbuster mafia movie will star a dream cast of Robert De Niro, Al Pacino, and just signed on Joe Pesci. This is an amazing opportunity to chat with you. Thank you so much for joining us today, sir.
My pleasure. I want to say one thing about what you just said.
Sure.
Paramount had been behind the film, and the film got expensive because they're using a new technique to de-age the actors so that that, for example, Bob De Niro, who's now 73 years old,
right,
can play Frank Sheeran at 73 or 75 or whatever, But with this de-aging process that they use now, he can play Frank Sheeran at the age of 30 and look and act just like Frank Sheeran would look and act at the age of 30. And they're doing the same thing for Joe Pesci, who's playing the mafia boss Russell Bufalino at various ages, and Al Pacino, who's playing Jimmy Hoffa at various ages. And this is an expensive proposition. So Paramount has bowed out, and the expense is now being handled by Netflix. This is a big feather in their cap to produce a major motion picture like this. And they're putting like $120 million into it. So,
wow. Well, and that de-aging software is amazing. I know they used it in Guardians of the Galaxy on Kurt Russell.
Yeah.
De-aging him to looking like he's about 25, 26 years old, and it was incredible. So it'll be amazing to see the final work on this. But this book, now you've re-released it again last year, and you included an update with 57-page conclusion that features new independent corroboration of Frank Sheeran's revelations about the killing of Jimmy Hoffa, the killing of Joey Gallo, and the murder of JFK, along with other stories that have not been told before. So I wanted our listeners to know that, although this book has been out for a while, the updated version was re-released back in June of 2016 with brand new information and a new conclusion. I want to start off getting to know a little bit about you, Charlie, if you don't mind. We talked off air, and your life is just as fascinating to me as the story that we're about to work on here this evening. How did you come into law enforcement? This was kind of an interesting twist I had never heard of before.
Well, what happened is that in the mid to late 60s, I was working as a welfare investigator in East Harlem, and things were pretty calm in this country still. And I decided to go to law school, went to law school, graduated, and was offered a job in Delaware, which is about 2 hours south of New York City, my home. And I went down there to work as a prosecuting attorney, what you think of on Law and Order, the TV show, the DA's office, you know. And when I got down there and met with the attorney general, he explained to me that Delaware, and especially Wilmington, Delaware, had been forever a sleepy little city, a kind of a suburb of Philadelphia. People didn't lock their front doors. Some people didn't even have keys to their front doors. And all of a sudden, there was this crime wave, which if you look around, we're still in. But at that time, it was it hadn't even hit New York City. I mean, it was such an unusual crime wave. It was fueled by drugs, of course. We knew that, but we were seeing all kinds of criminals. I say it's an unusual crime wave because we were seeing all kinds of criminals being set free by judges, and that had never happened before. And it was something that the Attorney General of Delaware wanted to combat. So he explained to me that we'll swear you in as a Deputy Attorney General. And then I'll sit down, and then the chief of police will come on, and he will swear you in as a police officer. And we don't want to see our cases here in Delaware thrown out of court because a cop made a mistake in connection with an arrest or a search and seizure. And we want you to be there, particularly in the important or the, you know, the crimes like murder, particularly in the more noteworthy crimes. And we want you to be there on the scene when the body is found and begin to supervise the police and be there to answer their questions and participate in the homicide investigation. Well, it turns out that growing up in New York City, having been a junior high English teacher and having worked in East Harlem as a welfare investigator, and growing up Italian, I had a little bit of a gift of gab. And it turned out I knew how to talk to criminals. And it turned out I knew how to get confessions from them. And so pretty quickly, I was in charge of homicide investigations. Pretty quickly, I was made the Chief Deputy Attorney General of the state of Delaware. And those relationships that I had with the police of that day, I still have. They call me. It was an unusual position to be in, where I'm there working alongside them, learning from them, and at the same time teaching them how to get confessions out of people, teaching them how to get cooperation out of reluctant witnesses. And it was a fascinating career. I set out to have. Yeah, it was really fabulous. I mean, I can tell you chapter and verse of various cases that I handled. And I have a very good memory, and I still remember the names of the cases and that sort of thing. And anyway.
Well, Charlie, let me ask you this real quickly. Do they still employ this type of tactic? Because it seems like that would help. That would help a lot of these cases maybe get stronger cases or start to help these cases that we seem to have, how do I want to put this politely, you know, there's a lot of people sitting in prison for crimes they did not commit because law was in a hurry and cut some corners. And it's a well-known fact. I mean, I'm not attacking law enforcement. I believe in them, love what they do, and it needs to be done. But it seems that if they had somebody like you out there doing this, that would start cleaning up a lot of the issues that, you know, wrongful imprisonment and jailing, that seems like that would limit that substantially.
Well, you're certainly running with the idea. I believe that it wouldn't do what today what it did then. What it did then was rules were changed constantly, and we had to be ahead of the rules.
Mm-hmm.
So if a cop wanted to do something, he had to ask my permission, and I had to imagine whether that thing that he wanted to do was going to be upheld a year from now. The rules were in a constant state of flux. And so today they're not anymore. They're pretty well established. These are the rules, and cops now know them. In those days, cops were having trouble understanding them. They were counterintuitive. They went against everything that they had been taught, these new rules. I'll give you an example of how they work today. The O.J. Simpson case, when he was followed by in the white Bronco, and he was trying to escape. He had a wig. He had his passport. He had just under $10,000 in cash, and he was trying to. And he had a gun, and he was trying to make a getaway. He knew he was caught. He knew he was done. He knew he was doomed, and he was followed by the police, who eventually got him to turn around, and they followed him to his home. He had been at home on an ankle bracelet on home confinement, out on bail. And so that prison, that break of his, was an attempt to get away. Well, here he was returning back to the house. And when he returned back to the house, for an old interrogator like me, he was at his absolute weakest. He was ready to confess. And I tell people that my Italian grandmother would have gotten a confession out of O.J. very easily by saying, "O.J., what did that Jezebel to you do to you? She make you jealous, didn't she? Oh, Mama Rosa, if you only knew what I put up with, you know." But under the rules, as enunciated by former Supreme Court Justice Earl Warren, Chief Justice Earl Warren, and many other members of his court, under the rules, the police were not permitted to ask him a single question. It was as if O.J. Simpson carried around with him a mute button on a remote control, and he could just flick the mute button and the cops' voices would go away. They were forbidden from saying even, "Hey, O.J., how was the drive?" You know, they couldn't ask him a single question, and they knew that. Back in my day, they didn't know that yet. These rules were new.
Why would that be, though? I mean, that does seem counterintuitive to building a case. If you've got somebody at the moment where you've brought them back, you've got them kind of where you need them, it's not a high-pressure situation, but as you said, almost like a friend, "Hey, OJ, God, what? Just tell us what happened. I mean, did she put you up to this because of her cheating ways or whatever?" I see where you're going with that, and just making it like a conversation, almost empathizing with the criminal.
It's so counterintuitive that Canada does not have these rules. Great Britain does not have these rules. No country in the world, Mexico does not have these rules. No country in the world has these rules but the United States of America. And these were not rules that the people voted for or passed on in any way. These were rules that were foisted upon the unsuspecting public. And I wrote a book about it called The Right to Remain Silent in 1988. It was based on, and as a lawyer, I knew when it was okay to question and I knew when it wasn't okay to question, you know. And so the cops needed that guidance. And as I mentioned earlier, I pretty quickly showed a talent for it. I remember the first time I talked to an interrogator that I admired, a man named Charlie Burke. He was a detective sergeant on the Wilmington Police Department. And a heroin addict named Randolph Dickerson had climbed down the fire escape, used a screwdriver to break in through the window of an elderly woman. She actually supplemented her Social Security by selling Bibles in black churches in Wilmington. And so she was the Bible sales, it was the Bible sales lady case. Well, she walked in on him, and Randolph stabbed her to death with his screwdriver, and then beat a hasty retreat out of the apartment. And he was a suspect, and Charlie Burke was able to question him, and Burkey got a confession from him. And I said to Burkey, how do you do it? I see you getting confessions, and I want to be able to do that. How do you do it? And Burkey looked at me with a straight face, and he said, they want to tell you, child. And I didn't believe it. Who wants to tell you? Who wants to confess? What do you mean they want to tell you? Is that your euphemism for strong-arming them or somehow overpowering their will? It wasn't. It was Burkey's way of getting a confession. And later, when I taught interrogation to cops based on my experiences and taught cross-examination to other lawyers, the first thing I would do is talk to them about Charlie Burke and his famous line to me, they want to tell you, child. And I began to practice that. And it worked. They do want. There's something about confessing that's almost a basic human need. You see it in religions. I was raised Catholic, so I certainly know the Catholic religion's approach toward confession. It forms a basis of psychiatry. It forms a basis of these 12-step programs for the poor addicts out there. Part of their becoming sober includes their confessing their misdeeds in this world. And so it comes instinctively. Now, there are parts of the human anatomy that don't want to confess. Your toes don't want to confess because you will go to jail on those toes. You
right.
know? But your soul wants to confess. And it doesn't take long before people begin to see what I'm saying, and they begin to agree with me the way I eventually came to agree with Charlie Burke about the place of confession. So this was something that became a bit of a cause for me. I thought, someday I'm going to try to reform these laws and make America more like Canada when it comes to law enforcement, because you could go over the bridge in Windsor, Canada, and you're an FBI, let's say an FBI agent. The FBI agent who goes over the bridge in Windsor, Canada, has to leave his gun behind in America. They don't have a problem with guns in Canada. They search you. They get them off the street, and those cases are not thrown out by some artificial court rulings. So anyway,
why is it? Why it does, but. Please give me the perspective that you can from your side and the law side. Why are we the only country that doesn't do this? Why? It makes no sense. And I know a lot of our listeners are scratching their heads about this as well. If it can, you know, and there's a difference between what you're saying and badgering some, you know, low IQ individual in a cell for 12 hours till they break and confess to something they may or may not have actually done. You're talking about a completely different aspect of this.
Totally, completely. I'm talking about throwing out the baby with the bathwater. And the people who created these rules in their whole lives, all they ever did was be nice to high up politicians. A judge is a lawyer who knows a governor. They have no experience in homicide investigation, no experience in law and order, and they sit back and devise new rules, and then they pass the rule around among their colleagues with a little note. Your Honor, I thought you might be interested in this new twist on taking a confession from a woman whose husband is found dead in the garage. You know, I mean, I've seen these things. I know what goes on. So I set about to try to shine a light on it. And I wrote a book in 1988 called The Right to Remain Silent. It was a novel, but it was based on cases that I had solved through interrogation and specific cases. And the book uses the very language I used in my interrogation and the very language that the suspect used in answering my questions. So it's a kind of primer on that period in law enforcement when things were going haywire. The book takes place in 1976, and it's a Rip Van Winkle kind of story where it's out of print now, but you can still get it. There's a bookstore, in fact, that has about 3,000 copies of it. You can find that reference on my website, charlesbrantauthor.com. Anyway, it's about a Wilmington, Delaware police officer who has a knack for interrogation and who is framed. As a result, he goes to jail. When he gets out of jail, he gets a job offer in Brazil to work in an opal mine, and he's sick of America, and he leaves and goes to work. And then 15 years later, in 1976, his reputation is cleared back in Delaware by a criminal who entered the witness protection program and admitted to framing my detective hero, Lou Razzi. And did I mention I was Italian, by the way? So, even though I don't have an Italian last name. Anyway, I named my hero after a buddy of mine, Lou Razzi. And so Lou is told that if he comes back to Wilmington and works one day, he bridges the years for purposes of getting a pension. And he works one day, they'll bridge all those years from the time he was wrongfully convicted until that one day that he worked, and he would get his police pension. And so that's chapter one. And he comes back to America to a whole different world. He comes back and he works one day, and in that one day he solves a crime the old-fashioned way by questioning the suspect, and he gets what they call an illegal confession. The case is thrown out. He got the confession from a 16-year-old boy who had molested a 4-year-old boy and left the 4-year-old boy for dead with what are called petechial hemorrhages in his face from the attempted suffocation of the boy. And that causes Lou Razzi to decide to stay and try to solve the case under these new rules and to learn these new rules. So it's a history. It's a history of what was happening in 1976 in America and how it was happening to law enforcement. And so I wrote that book. I got a letter, unsolicited letter, from then President Ronald Reagan commending me on my efforts on behalf of law-abiding citizens. TriStar Pictures took an option on it. Then I wrote an article for the Reader's Digest explaining it more in greater detail. And then I got ill. And then I got really sick, and I couldn't write anymore. And I only, when I finally retired from the practice of law and moved to Idaho, I found that this illness, which is based on an underlying allergy to mold, it's called a type 3 allergy, and it causes your blood vessels to cramp up, and you get a loss of blood flow. And so I moved out here to Sun Valley, Idaho, where I now live in the high desert, and I do so much better with my health here. And it was then, when I retired from the practice of law, that I wrote I heard you paint houses. And went back to a writing career, so to speak. I never did. I got a second commission to write another article for the Reader's Digest, and I was just too sick to do it. So comparing Canada to the United States, the first article I wrote was about the new rules and what the consequences of the new rules on police work. So
Canada definitely seems to have it much better. I mean, they don't report on the names. They keep a lot of that out so that people can get fair and just trials. It just seems like we could still learn a lot, even though we think we're the superior country in so many ways. I think we need to reevaluate the law enforcement tactics and allow police officers to do their work efficiently again, instead of worrying about all this bureaucratic red tape and crap, which I'm sure lends to a lot of the stress and pressure to police officers out in the field, which leads to a lot of these violent incidents.
Today's police officer enters the field knowing this.
Right.
Today's police officer watches it on Law and Order. Hey, he lawyered up. You hear that today on TV.
Right.
He lawyered up. He won't talk to me. You know, there was no such thing as lawyering up when I was a young man growing up Italian in New York. You answer to policemen's questions.
Right.
Anyway, I digress, I guess. But
no, it's fascinating to hear about you. Yeah, the right to remain silent. We'll put a link up to our guest website so you can find it and find the books.
Thank you.
Now, help me out here, if you would. We've got a lot of younger listeners that have started to join us, Charlie, and are intrigued and interested in true crime, but have no clue who the players are in today's talk. Jimmy Hoffa, can you give us a brief background so we can get some people up to speed on what we're going to be talking about in this segment?
I'd be happy to. When we talk about labor leaders today, we think about whether there's going to be a baseball season or not, because the lawyer for the Players Association or the lawyers for the NFL Players Association, not the lawyers, I'm sorry, but the presidents of the unions. And we don't understand that the United States of America once had a very robust, viable system of unions that protected the workers, that made sure that the employers gave in the union contracts, that the employers gave health care, health insurance to their workers, that the employers gave pensions to their workers. And the Teamsters was the truck drivers union. And Jimmy Hoffa became president of the Teamsters in 1957. Jimmy Hoffa had a voice that was known to everyone in America at the time. His voice was as well known as the Beatles' voices were about to become, or as well known as Elvis's. You heard him on the radio, you heard him on TV, you knew this was Jimmy Hoffa, and he was like a one-track record. All he talked about was how the working men and women in America haven't had a raise. They get screwed every year by politicians. And he just kept hammering it home. Now, he had allied himself with certain mobsters. And he felt that he needed them because management used hired mobsters as well. And so Jimmy Hoffa became president of the union in 1957. And he contacted the most powerful mafia boss in America at the time, a man by the name of Rosario Bufalino, mostly known as Russell Bufalino. And he asked Russell for some muscle. He now had taken over. He knew that in order to do his best work for the working men and women of America, he needed solidarity. And he couldn't allow rebels who were working against him and working to undermine his administration, he couldn't allow that to happen. He had to have them killed. And so he called Bufalino and asked for some muscle, and Bufalino referred Frank the Irishman Sheeran, who had done some killings for Bufalino, and Bufalino put Sheeran on the phone with Hoffa, who was calling from Detroit, and the first words that Hoffa uttered to Frank Sheeran were, "I heard you paint houses." And to paint a house is to whack a guy in those olden days. The paint was the blood that spattered on the walls and the floor. And Sheeran replied, I do my own carpentry work too, which means I get rid of the bodies. And they flew Frank out to Detroit, and he began doing hits for Hoffa as he had done hits for Sheeran, before Buffalino. He would be, on occasion, he would be arrested, but no one would be able to prove anything against him. And it was a situation when Jimmy Hoffa disappeared in 1975, July 30th, 1975, that the FBI heard from informants out there who mingled among organized crime who had abducted Hoffa and killed him. And tops on the list was Frank Sheeran. Also on the list was Russell Buffalino. There were eight people on the list of known suspects, but they had no evidence against them. They just had the hearsay of informants. And they went after, the FBI went after these eight people the way the IRS went after Al Capone in the 1920s. They never got Al Capone for murder. They never got him for bootlegging. He's the biggest bootlegger in the history of the world. But they got him for not paying his income taxes on the illegal money. And so they went after Frank Sheeran, and they went after Russell Buffalino, and they got Frank Sheeran on labor racketeering. They got him a 32-year sentence when someone else would have gotten maybe 5 years, and they were trying to put pressure on Frank Sheeran. And pressure was never going to work on a guy like Sheeran. An interrogator like Charlie Burke or like me would use a much different approach than pressure on a tough guy like Sheeran. Frank Sheeran was raised a strict Catholic by a father who studied for the priesthood for 5 years, and by a mother who went to Mass every morning of her life. Frank had never done anything wrong before he went into the war in 1941. He was 21 years old, and when he entered into General Patton, and I hope you've seen the movie called Patton, General Patton's Killer Division, Patton called it. He explained to the members of the 45th Infantry Division that he wanted them to be the most feared among the German soldiers of all of his divisions. And if they try to surrender, well, maybe you don't understand what they're saying, but we don't want to be taking prisoners. And so Frank was not only in that 45th Infantry Division, he was in it for 411 combat days, when the average number of combat days for an infantryman was 80, and when if you had 200 combat days, you could be discharged if you so chose. He did not choose to be discharged. And he found himself in this war, 411 combat days. He found himself liberating the Dachau concentration camp, and he learned how to kill in the army, but he learned a new way of looking at the world. And when he got out of the army, after the war, he explained to me that you'd wake up in the middle of the night sweating and wondering what you were doing in a bed. He said they didn't have war syndrome then, but you knew something was different. You knew something was wrong. And I can recommend to the young people out there a terrific movie called The Best Years of Our Lives. It was the Academy Award winning movie for 1946. And it's about those GIs who returned from combat to America and had to readjust to life. And they're full of deep emotional turmoil from the war. The best years of our lives. And Frank gave the best years of his life in the service of our country. And when he got out, again, he had never really done anything wrong. When he got out, he got a job as a truck driver. He got married to a lovely Irish gal. They had three children. Frank was 6'4", weighed 220 pounds, and he also taught ballroom dancing, if you can believe it, Dancing with the Stars. He taught ballroom dancing, the foxtrot, the waltz, that sort of thing, because he was very light on his feet. And as a truck driver, he began to have free time to spend in what they call downtown Philadelphia, and that's the Italian part. That's the part you see in the movie Rocky. And Frank learned to speak fluent Italian, very bright man, and he learned to speak fluent Italian during the Italian campaign in the war. And so he would go down with these other truck drivers who happened to be Italian and speak Italian with them. And one day, a man named Whispers DiTullio came to him with a proposition. Whispers was a loan shark, and he had lent money to the Cadillac Linen Service. And the Cadillac Linen Service couldn't keep up their payments on what they call the VIG, the excess interest on a loan shark loan, because they were losing all their business to another linen company. The linen is a laundry where they launder the linen for hotels and restaurants, tablecloths, that sort of thing. And Whispers wanted the rival linen laundry to be torched to the ground so that Cadillac, the one he had lent money to, would get their clients back and would then be in a position to repay him the money he had lent them. And he was going to pay Sheeran $10,000, $2,000 down and $8,000 when the job was done. And Sheeran went over to Cadillac and looked around and looked here and there and began to formulate a plan. And he returned to downtown Philly and got a word that the boss of the Philly family, Russell Bufalino, was boss of the state of Pennsylvania, except for Philadelphia. He was boss of parts of Ohio, parts of upstate New York, parts of New York City, and parts of New Jersey, parts of Florida, and parts of Montreal. He was a huge boss, Russell Bufalino. But Angelo Bruno was the boss of the city of Philadelphia, mafia boss, and he brought Sheeran in on the carpet and said, "What are you doing going down there nosing your way around the Cadillac dealership, the Cadillac laundry service?" And Frank said, "Well, Whispers DiTullio hired me to torch you." And Angelo Bruno said, "Look, I own a piece of that laundry, that Cadillac laundry that you're about to torch. And you have to come and check before you go and do something like that. And Whispers knows that you have to check." And here Whispers was putting you out on a limb. You'd be the only one, your license plate would be the only thing known by the people that run the Cadillac. They would have seen you down there. You would then torch their linen service, and they would torch you. They would kill you. And Whispers would end up not having to pay you the other $8,000. What do you think of that, Irishman? So you got to take care of Whispers, or you're going to go. Something's going to be done about you for not having brains enough to check higher up. And so you got to take care of Whispers. And that was the first killing that Frank did as a civilian. And it came 10 years after the war, and it was him or me, Whispers or me. And so he sought out Whispers, found him, and shot him in the head right out on the street. And the next day he saw the photo in the paper and said, "You know, that could have been me," looking at it. And once you do something like that, once you kill somebody like that, they own you. And so Russell Bufalino and Angelo then would tell Frank what to do. "You got to do this and you got to do that. And you can't say no to these people," or the way Frank expressed it, "or you'll go to Australia too," which means you'll go down under and be buried. So that's how Frank got mixed up with the mafia and went.
And Jimmy Hoffa, and you see, FBI, I guess he was a businessman, had these plans, but he... in essence, it seems like, was very much a mob-like character, right? I mean, calling people in on hits and being involved in the things he was in on. He wasn't really the man of the people that he portrayed himself to be then.
Well, or he was. Or he was. Or he had a dual approach to his work. The things that he did, that he accomplished for the Union, are still in existence today. He just felt that at times he had to fight fire with fire.
So, understandably, sure. I mean, not that I'm saying it's okay to murder, but I understand it was a different time and a different feel, and trying to get the things done that he was doing, there was going to be some pushback from different groups that weren't as keen on the idea, I'm guessing.
Well, yeah, they weren't as keen on the idea. Some of these people in his own union didn't want the reforms that he was putting in. They wanted to shake down the trucking companies. So, you know, if you were a shakedown artist, you'd go to the Phil Milestone Trucking Company, and you'd say, you can have labor peace, or you can have wildcat strikes. You can have labor peace where morale is high, or you can have cargo begin to disappear from out of your trucks.
A little gentle persuasion?
Yeah, you decide, and I'm the guy you pay. And there were a number of these people that did that kind of work, and Hoffa got rid of them all. He didn't allow that. How he made some money, and he used his money, it would come right out of his pocket to help people. But how he made his money, the Teamsters, Hoffa created something called the Central States Pension Fund, so that when Teamsters retired, they had a pension. That darn good pension. And they had retiree benefits, medical benefits and burial benefits and that sort of thing. And they were treated like human beings as a result of these reforms of Hoffa's. And it's amazing how his son keeps getting elected every year, or every 5 years, as the boss of the Teamsters, James P. Hoffa. The original Jimmy Hoffa was James R. Hoffa. And James P. Hoffa, as we sit here, is president of the Teamsters Union today on the strength of his father's name.
Hmm.
You know, the rank and file loved him. And they loved what he managed to get for them. The book goes through that. It explains all of that. And it allows for differing opinions. I mean, you can read that and say, okay, but he's still a murderer. Or you could read that and say, okay, these were different times, and I'm not here to judge Hoffa. But in the end, he was the victim. He was the victim of what he did with the Central States Pension Fund. He created the Central States Pension Fund, and then it became the second largest lender of money for real estate ventures in the country, second to the Chase Bank. Now, I don't know if they call it Chase Manhattan. I lose track, but it was the Chase Bank. And they lent commercial real estate loans. So did the Central States Pension Fund. And if you wanted to build a casino in Las Vegas, you'd go to Russell Bufalino in upstate Pennsylvania, and you'd secure a loan through Russell's good offices, and Russell would take 10% of the loan. So if it was a $30 million casino, Russell would get $3 million, and he would split that with Jimmy. And ultimately, Jimmy went to jail, and while he was in jail, he put a figurehead in charge of the union, and Jimmy attempted to run the union from prison, but it didn't work out. The figurehead took over, and the figurehead allowed the mafia to infiltrate the pension fund. That was one thing that you could do business with Hoffa. The mafia did business with Hoffa on the pension fund, but they always did it on Hoffa's terms. Hoffa had interest paid and the loans were secured. And when you went to Russell Bufalino to borrow the $30 million, whoever you were, however big you thought you were, you knew you were borrowing money, and you knew that Russell Bufalino, if you didn't pay it, would have you killed. So it had a certain
insurance policy. Yeah.
Insurance policy. Well, Fitz, the guy who took over for Hoffa, didn't have those skills. He just let the mafia walk all over him. And when Hoffa got out of jail, he was pardoned by then President Nixon, who was paid off. And Frank, the Irishman Sheeran, explains all that in the book. And I had him to myself for close to 5 years on audio tapes and videotape. And you could see my techniques of interrogation with him. As an example, one of the things you do, I know I'm going off subject a little bit, but one of the things you do if you want a man with a conscience to confess and you want to relieve some of his guilt, taking a confession is a journey from trust, you get him to trust you, and then unburdening, you get him to unburden himself. Because when he confesses, he physically feels good in the chest. And you tell him that. And you tell him that the more he tells, the better he's going to feel. And it works. And one of the things that I did with Sheeran to take away some of his sense of guilt in connection with Hoffa's disappearance was I told him that Hoffa deserved it, that Hoffa had played fast and loose with all the rules, and that Hoffa refused to listen to Russell when Russell told him to retire and get out of union work. And I even went so far as to say on tape, Frank, I'd have killed him myself. He had it coming, you know, and you do that. It's trickery, but you do that to relieve his conscience a little bit and makes it easier for him to tell you. So,
with that said, though, Charlie, I'm going to take you into two directions here, but I want to follow up on what you just said. We've all been in that situation where you're sitting at a bar and you're talking BS with your buddies. And, you know, you hit a home run today. He's talking to you about how yesterday he hit 3 home runs. Suddenly you're like, man, I know exactly what you're talking about. I was in a game yesterday and I hit 4 and, you know, I caught 3. There's always kind of this one-upsman between men. There just is. How do you know that when you're kind of relating to him and you're saying, yeah, you know, he did deserve it and I would have whacked him myself if I was in the position, how do you know that he's not just tough guying up with you and he's, you know, he's not really admitting the truth, but he's admitting something to keep you impressed or keep you interested in the story?
I had him for 5 years. I questioned him and re-questioned him. And I'm a professional at it.
Mm-hmm.
I wrote a book on.
No, and I understand that. I'm just saying from the audience perspective, well, you know, we all have that one-upsmanship. And it seems like those guys might be the kind that would kind of sometimes speak a little more.
They would never do that.
Interesting. All right.
They would never do that. They're taught to keep their mouths shut.
Mm-hmm.
Frank told the people that we were hanging around with, I was in the company of some very serious gangsters, and Frank told them all that I was writing a book that was going to clear him of involvement in Hoffa, that he was listed as the number one suspect by the FBI in profiles in the New York Times and Newsweek and in 6 books on Hoffa's disappearance. Frank was listed as the top suspect in the killing of Hoffa. And so he's telling these people that I'm writing this book that's going to clear him. And he knew that instead he was giving me serial confession after serial confession. And if he gave me a confession today and told it a certain way, 3 months later, 3 years later, I would revisit the topic and have him tell me and listen to it again. You become so adept at knowing, at discerning the truth from the lie, that you're like the high school choir master who can hear that boy up in the top row who's a little off key. And there's 50 boys in the boys choir, and he can spot that one, and he knows just who it is. Well, you learn how to spot that lie. It has a clunkiness to it. It does not have a ring of truth to it. And that doesn't mean that Frank didn't lie to me. He did. And I talk about that in the book, the occasions when he did. And it mostly it was to save the reputations of other people, other gangsters. And, you know, I had no interest in knowing their business anyway. I didn't want to end up their victims.
Well, that's what I was curious about, doing what you were doing and talking to who you were talking to and being in the circle of some, you know, seedy businessmen. Did you ever have a fear that getting this information could put you in their crosshairs?
Twice, and I put those examples in the book. There were two occasions when I had concern. There was another occasion when maybe I should have had concern, but I wasn't. And that was when Russell Bufalino's family was taken over by his underboss and nephew, a guy by the name of Billy D'Elia. And I had a paralegal in my medical malpractice field who dated a guy that knew Billy. And as the book was coming out in 2004, it was going to be released in the stores on a Monday. But in the Friday and Saturday before that, there was a lot of publicity. And my former paralegal sent my wife an email that she had gotten from this ex-boyfriend of hers who was a friend of Billy D'Elia's. And the boyfriend had written, P.S., Billy is not happy with Charlie. Now, when they're not happy with you, you're done. And the expression that you'll learn in the book, full of these expressions, is when in doubt, have no doubt. You doubt somebody's trustworthiness, you kill them. When in doubt, have no doubt. And so here we were getting this email, P.S., Billy is not happy with Charlie. And I said to my wife, Nancy, look, he hasn't seen the book yet. The name Billy D'Elia does not appear at all in the book. I kept him out of the book completely. So he hasn't seen that yet. On Monday, he'll see that. And so that was that one time when I wasn't scared, but my wife was. There were two other occasions the book talks about where I personally was scared. So,
but it kept you from jumping ship. What was the persistence for? I mean, when you have one time where you're really worried for your life is one moment, but you had two. Why keep going forward?
Well, I had done that professionally. I mean, I was not, you know, I'd had my life threatened as a prosecutor. I mean, it was part of what I did. You know, it was my profession. I wrote a book about it. And the way Frank got me involved, he was in jail, 32-year sentence, and I got a call from the Philly, and I was doing medical work, mm-hmm. and I got a call from the Philly, a Philly guy who wanted Frank sprung on medical grounds, that he had a severe spinal stenosis, an arthritic condition in his spinal column that was impinging his spinal cord. He was losing the ability to use his right leg, and they had it in a brace because of the pressure on the nerve, on the spinal cord. And so would I get him out of jail, and they would pay me a fee, and I got him out of jail. And he took us to lunch, my office staff, and eight guys named Rocco. We all went to lunch. And after lunch, he took me aside, and he said, I'm tired of being written about in all the books on Hoffa. He said, I want to tell my side of it. And I read your book, The Right to Remain Silent, in jail. Now, this is a book that Ronald Reagan liked. This is a law and order book. This is a book urging that the police have more leeway in the solving of crimes. That's what it stood for. Frank read that book, and Frank wanted me to write his book clearing him of any involvement in Hoffa, and I knew immediately that this man had something to get off his chest. This man had something that he wanted to confess and needed to confess. And it's a very human story. It's a spiritual journey, this book. You know, he starts out as a young boy in the Depression, as a young man going off to war, trying to make the best of civilian life, and then falling in with some people that he could not have imagined were as big as they were. Most Americans couldn't imagine it at the time. When Frank got involved with them, it was 1955. I was just starting high school. I had no idea that there was a nationwide mafia. We didn't learn about the nationwide mafia until 1957 in the famous raid on mobsters who were having a meeting in Apalachin, New York, in upstate New York. And the police in those days were allowed to raid them. Or we wouldn't even know it today.
Right.
They raided them and arrested about 60 of them. You actually see it depicted in a comedy. Billy Crystal and Bob De Niro's
Analyze This
movie called Analyze This or Analyze That or something,
right.
You know. So
his original thought was to come to you to try to have you clear his name of this. But he starts to turn around. Okay. And
in one day, I met with him, and in one day he started confessing. And I was the father confessor. I was the authority figure there to receive the confession.
Would he ever tell you, you know, yeah, this is what happened, this was, but you know what, I don't want you to tell this part of the story, Charlie. Leave this part out. Is that how you were able to go forward with him?
There were things about Billy D'Elia that he told me, and he told me to leave him out. There were things that reflected on Russell that he told me to leave out. Because there were other people involved with Russell in those ventures or adventures, and they would wonder if I told you about Russell as close as I was to Russell, what would I say about them? And they're not pussycats either. So he would give me guidance as we went, you know, and I would keep them out. I mean, when in doubt, keep it out. With my wife and me, you know, that we handled it.
Did he show remorse?
Making a movie of it now, and Martin Scorsese is directing it. Bob De Niro is going to play Frank the Irishman Sheeran. The current edition of the book that has the 57 added pages to it is full of corroboration for all that Frank told me, including what he did to Hoffa. That's corroborated in the book. The fact that he killed Crazy Joey Gallo at Umberto's Clam House is corroborated in the conclusion chapter. Coincidentally, there was a New York Times reporter who went on to become the National Assignment Editor, such that you didn't write an article for the New York Times unless she assigned it to you. Well, as a journalism student, she happened to be at Umberto's Clam House the night that Crazy Joey Gallo was whacked inside the Clam House. And she positively identified Frank Sheeran as the shooter. And so that was the Gallo hit. And then there's information about the mob's involvement in the JFK assassination. And that was corroborated by the release of FBI records pursuant to a law that gradually releases the Kennedy records. And these were released in 2008. And Frank had already confessed to me, and I had published his confession concerning the JFK assassination, the mob's involvement in it, and I published that in 2004. So here we were 4 years later getting police FBI reports that corroborated what Frank said. So it's fascinating. It's solved. So I said, Scorsese's directing. De Niro is going to play Frank the Irishman Sheeran. Al Pacino is going to play Hoffa. Joe Pesci is going to play Russell Bufalino. Harvey Keitel is going to play the mafia boss, Angelo Bruno. Ray Romano from Everybody Loves Raymond is going to play the mafia mob lawyer, Bill Bufalino. Same name as Russell, but technically not cousins, but they spoke as were cousins.
Right.
Anyway, it's got an all-star cast. They're going to and the screenplay is written by the adaptation of the book is written by Steve Zalian, who won the Oscar for Schindler's List, and they're going to start filming in late September, coming up in a month in New York City. So
a lot of the ways gangsters and people like this are portrayed in books that have come out before, and in of course the Hollywoodized versions of these accounts, that they're usually pretty irredeemable. There's nothing really left human about them in the sense that killing is nothing. You had a chance to talk with this man for 5 years and hear these stories. Was there remorse or regret in the work that he did and the people that he had to kill?
Totally. And that was what kept me going. And that was what kept him going. As I mentioned, he had been a strict Catholic. His father studied for the priesthood for 5 years before he married his mother. His mother went to Mass every morning. Frank was a product of a good moral code. He believed in sin. He believed in confession. And in the Catholic faith, they refer to what Frank was doing as a deathbed conversion. He knew his days were limited on earth, and as he expressed it, I believe there's something more after this life, and if I got a shot at it, I don't want to close the door. And he's quoted in the book extensively on this. And as I said, it's a spiritual journey. You know, it's a guy that did some very bad things. Now, there were some murders that he did not have remorse about. He did not have remorse about killing Crazy Joey Gallo in Umberto's Clam House. But he had tremendous remorse about a couple of the others that he did.
Did he give any information on the final whereabouts of Hoffa's remains? Will that always remain a mystery, or do you believe that we will find them eventually?
No, it's in the book. Hoffa was within an hour of his disappearance. He was cremated through the efforts of a mob-connected funeral parlor in Detroit called Bagnasco Funeral Parlor, and the deed was done at the Evergreen Crematorium. That's the crematorium that Bagnasco's dealt with. And this was corroborated by an FBI informant at the time telling an FBI agent named Teresa Mack, and this was after my book came out, and Teresa Mack called me up to tell me, you got it, by the way. I had an informant who had told me that. A trustworthy informant. So
the body was disposed of within an hour. There will never be a trace of Hoffa in Shea Stadium or at the bottom of the Poseidon Adventure. There's never going to be trace evidence to prove that.
No, but
one thing or another.
I'll tell you an interesting little. It's all proven. Mm-hmm. I was a trial lawyer,
right?
Not just a homicide investigator. And so I know what it takes to prove a case. So it's all proven. And the 57-page edition slams it shut on each one of those three issues. The issue of Crazy Joey Gallo, the issue of Jimmy Hoffa, and the issue of JFK being killed by the mafia. They got a nut, and that's how they did that one. Anyway, and that, as I mentioned, was corroborated by the release of FBI reports in 2008. The Crazy Joey Gallo was corroborated by an eyewitness, a journalist who happened to be there. And Billy D'Elia, who didn't like me even a little bit, ended up getting arrested for money laundering, and he ordered hits on the two witnesses against him, and the person he gave the order to was wearing a wire. So they arrested Billy for conspiracy to kill government witnesses. So he took money laundering, which is bad enough, and he was now facing life. And he made a deal that in exchange for his cooperation, they would give him, instead of life, they would give him 9 years, which they did. If you remember a show on 60 Minutes about these two juvenile court judges who were putting kids into jail because they would make money out of it because they owned a piece of the jail, and they got paid per inmate. And so they get this little kid who's arrested for shoplifting, and they put him in the jail. Billy D'Elia uncovered that, and it was a big to-do on 60 Minutes, those two judges. Anyway, when they went to Billy, the first question they asked him in prison was, what happened to Hoffa? And he said, read the book. And he had given a copy of that book, of my book, to an underling of his named Frank Pavlico, and he had autographed it saying, sometimes you can believe what you read. So then the FBI called me up. They wanted my tapes, and I'm on good, excellent terms with the FBI on this case. But it's still an active case because a fellow named Chucky O'Brien, who was involved in the disappearance and murder of Hoffa, and a fellow named Steve Andretta, who was one of the two cleaners that cleaned up after the deed was done in the house. And by the way, we found the house. I drove him to Detroit. We found the house where Hoffa was lured to and where he was killed. And
Right, that's the house they went and pulled up the floorboards on and actually found DNA evidence, correct?
Well, they found, they only could tell that it was male blood from all these many years on a trail that fit what Frank Sheeran had said to me about what had happened to the body. So I'll tell you an interesting anecdote, and that is that Giant Stadium for years was a place that people would joke about.
Right.
And that's where he's buried. Well, I became friends with the Hoffa case agent, a man named Bob Garrity, and the case agent is the guy in charge of the entire investigation into the disappearance of Jimmy Hoffa. And he was the Hoffa case agent. He's the one that wrote this famous memo listing the eight suspects, including Sheeran and Buffalino and the rest of them. And he came to a book signing of mine. He said, make it out to Bob Garrity. And I said, how do I know that name? He said, well, I was the Hoffa case agent. And we became fast friends, and we're still in touch. Mostly about grandfather things,
Right. Why haven't they closed the book officially when you've got this kind of information and corroboration?
Because there still are two members of Bob Garrity's list that are alive and well. Tommy Andretta, who lives in Las Vegas, and Chucky O'Brien. That's not his real name. His real last name was Pagano. He was Italian. But Chucky O'Brien, who lives in Boca Raton, Florida. And so the FBI, as an organization, has rules, and their rules include not commenting ever on active cases. Now, you've seen that violated on TV, but that's a rule. And so right after Billy told the FBI to read my book, again, Billy, who didn't like me, didn't trust me, that's when they came and
subpoenaed everything from me.
Subpoenaed everything from me, but also visited Frank's daughters to see if he had given them anything to hold on to that would recant what he told me. And, of course, he hadn't. And as one of them, daughter Dolores, said to me, you know, I just told him to tell you the truth. Get it all out. She took him to a church, St. Dorothy's Church, to get absolution from Father Heldesore. And she gave him a good talking to on the way there. I didn't know this at the time I wrote my book. It was revealed in a newspaper article where she was interviewed, you know, after the book had been out a long time, you know, had been out a few years, that she drove him to I knew he had gotten absolution at St. Heldesore, but I didn't know that she had given him the third degree to make sure that he truly felt remorse. Because the whole family was Catholic, you know, his daughters totally wanted him to go to heaven under the rules of the Catholic religion. I was a pallbearer at funeral.
Why do you think people are still so fascinated? I mean, obviously the JFK case, because it is such a dark, twisted, covered up affair. But Jimmy Hoffa, why do people still care all these years later what happened to Jimmy Hoffa?
Well, I think there are less and less that care. I mean, as you mentioned earlier, young people, you're fortunate enough to have an audience of young, interested people who want to know about true crime, and God bless you for it. But they, as you said, they don't really know who Jimmy Hoffa is, except that he's the butt of these jokes. Well, the one joke that I was going to tell you about, and I changed the subject on you, was the idea that he was buried at Giant Stadium, which was newly constructed when he disappeared. And Bob Garrity explained to me, the Hoffa case agent, that the reason that they took that seriously and that they brought sensitive equipment to see if there was any detection of a body beneath the surface was because Russell Bufalino, who, as I mentioned earlier, owned the Copacabana nightclub, for example, he owned so many things in America. And one of the things that he had a piece in was the architectural firm that built Giant Stadium.
Hmm.
So they had to investigate it.
Right, because there was actually a tie to that.
Yeah, it was actually a tie to that. So it's a fascinating look at a different era.
Were you surprised by the information that he gave you regarding the assassination of JFK? Or was that something that you kind of felt was always the case? I mean, we know that Kennedy and his family pissed off a lot of people, but the mafia certainly was had a big part in helping him to become elected.
Yeah. I was teaching junior high English when he was killed. And that weekend, that Sunday, when Jack Ruby killed Oswald,
mm-hmm.
there wasn't anybody I knew in my Italian neighborhood that thought for a second that Jack Ruby's job was to kill Hoffa, to kill Oswald on the street after Oswald killed Kennedy. And when that was not done, Ruby had to go into that prison, into that police station, and do it, because the mafia had a lot worse things to do to you than march you in front of a judge if you failed.
Right.
I mean, they would torture you to death if you failed. And so from the moment of Jack Ruby's killing of Oswald, everyone I knew the fix was in and knew there was a story there. And then we kept not hearing it. And I ended up not reading a single book, not reading a single article. I would see these guys on TV, and I would know that they really didn't have anything to say. And then when I got interested in it as a result of my work with Frank Sheeran, I realized that I had to read some books, and I had to find out as much as I could about the JFK assassination. And I would pick up a book and see that it was written by a journalist. And my first question was, what possible knowledge does he have in investigating a homicide? He can't possibly know. And then I would read further and find out that he had no clue what clues meant, what actions signified other actions. And the more of these books that I forced myself to read, the more I was convinced that what the Warren Commission needed was two New York City homicide detectives. That's all. send the rest of them home.
Did he explain to you, and the thing that's always been curious to me is, you know, in hearing this angle, how did Oswald become the patsy then to this kind of story? If you believe the governmental conspiracy angles, I can see how they would bring in a patsy like Oswald. But the mafia, what was their ties to Oswald and including him in the story?
Well, the get a nut, it's called, getting a nut. It's what Crazy Joey Gallo did to Joe Colombo, the boss of the Colombo family, at a Italian-American Civil Rights League rally at Columbus Circle in New York. He got this black guy, and Crazy Joey Gallo was very tight with the black mafia portrayed in American Gangster, written by Steve Zalian, who adapted my book for the screen. And so Crazy Joey Gallo, who was feuding with Joe Colombo, had him killed by the nut. Now, the way a nut works, and they use him in Sicily, they use him in America. The way a nut works is he's promised to get away, clean getaway. He's assured that no one at the scene of the rally at Columbus Circle has a gun. And he's promised money. He's given a big down payment on that money. He's shown exactly how he's going to get out of the country and how they're going to get him out. And then he's going to show up, pose as a photographer, kill Colombo, and believe that he's going to be whisked into a car and driven away. And instead, he's promptly shot on the spot. And before Colombo hit the ground, practically, Jerome K. Johnson hit the ground. So it's called Getting a Nut. And it's what they did in this case. Oswald's connection to this was, he had attempted to kill the right-wing general Walker. He stalked him. Oswald, remember, was a communist, a avowed Marxist left-winger. He stalked this controversial general, Walker, and fired a shot through Walker's window, missing Walker by a hair because it was deflected by the window pane. While Walker was doing his income tax, of all things, that was April. And he used the same gun on Walker as he used on JFK. And that gun was traced to his possession through the mail order house that he bought the gun from. So here he is in New Orleans. And Carlos Marcello had the biggest motive of any of the mobsters to want to kill off JFK. The idea of killing JFK and not killing Bobby is that if you kill Bobby, the one you really want dead, JFK will retaliate, and they will leave no stone unturned, and they will get you. They will give get-out-of-jail-free passes to Jack the Ripper in exchange for evidence and tips. And so you're inviting trouble by killing Bobby. But if you kill JFK, LBJ, Lyndon Johnson, the president, was well known didn't like Bobby Kennedy. In fact, most people didn't like him. He was a very abrasive man. And if you get rid of JFK, as they say in Sicily, you get rid of the head and the tail dies too. If you get rid of the tail, the head doesn't die. So that was the reasoning and the motive that that Carlos Marcello had. Marcello's territory, he was the New Orleans crime boss, which meant that he owned the city of Dallas. He owned all of Texas. He owned Alabama in their way of dividing up territories. And Marcello had a bookmaker whose nickname was Dutz. And he was Lee Harvey Oswald's uncle. As well, Carlos Marcello had a pilot by the name of Dave Perry. And in 1992, a photograph of a Civil Air Patrol meeting, barbecue, was brought forward on Frontline Television. I think that's on PBS or something. And it shows Lee Harvey Oswald at the age of 15 in Dave Ferry's Civil Air Patrol club, or whatever they called them. It's like a Boy Scouts, you know, but mm-hmm. with piloting. And he was, and Dave Ferry was Marcello's well-known pilot. In fact, he's the character in the movie JFK that's played by Joe Pesci. This Dave Ferry guy. So anyway, there's a lot of connections, you know, and you can link them. But the main connection is in those documents that were released in 2008 that corroborate exactly what Frank Sheeran had told me. Okay, I've run out of gas. There you go.
I appreciate it, Mr. Brandt. It's a pleasure to speak with you. Charles Brandt, our guest this evening. We've got a link up to his website. The book is called I Heard You Paint Houses, Frank the Irishman Sheeran, and Closing the Case on Jimmy Hoffa. We'll have a link up to that. The movie will be coming out sometime in 2018 to Netflix, so we'll keep you apprised of that as it happens as well. Mr. Brandt, thank you so much for your time. And Tim, it's time we open up the mailbags and take a look at this week's Dumb Crimes and Stupid Criminals. And the first story, Tim, I've got to just say this up front. This isn't really a dumb crime, stupid criminal, but
okay. This
story is one that we talked about when the first time it broke, because you and I have been going back and forth whether we're going to be wiped out by Skynet or zombies.
Right.
And this story came up about a year ago, mm-hmm. and the follow-up is going on now, so I just wanted to follow through on this. This is a weird story, no matter how you cut it, and thankfully it still happens in Florida. So it kind of fits into the realm of weirdness that we like here on Dumb Crime, Stupid Criminals, Tim. We're going to Martin County, Florida, where the state attorney's office will not pursue the death penalty for Austin Haruf, who was accused of attacking and killing John Stevens and Michelle Michonne last August and seriously injuring their neighbor, Jeff Fisher, who tried to help the couple. Deputies say they found the then-muscular former high school football player and wrestler in his underwear, making animal noises, biting Stevens' face as he pinned his victim's body to the driveway.
What?
This is where it gets creepier. Court documents state that Haruf then told deputies, "Help me, I ate something bad," and then admitted it was humans as he spit out a piece of the flesh. Family members of the victims told our sister station, WPTV, according to this article, they were given notice earlier this week of the upcoming decision to not pursue the death penalty. TCPalm.com reports that the Treasure Coast prosecutor, who will try the Austin Haruf Jeff Hendricks case, said that after careful review of the case and applying the statute that controls the seeking of the death penalty, it was decided not to seek it. John Stevens III, the son of John Stevens, told WPTV in the past that he wanted the death penalty for Haruf, though he was not worried, though he was worried it might not happen. That worry is now his reality, but WPTV legal analyst Michelle Sussakauer said the state always acts in the best interest of the family of the victims. WPTV legal analyst Michelle Sussakauer said that the state always acts in the best interest of the family, and the state attorney is working in the interest of justice. She does not speak specifically about Haruf's case, but generally, she said, a state attorney is going to pursue a penalty that they reasonably believe they're going to be able to achieve. That was creepy. You remember when that attack took place? And I've still not seen if it was a FLACA case or what the hell this guy was on that made him attack and eat these people.
Yeah, I do remember the case. I don't know. There are different. It seems like there are different drugs, that whether they be bath salts or, like you mentioned, FLACA or even spice. There's certain strains of spice where people have ended up chewing on others that get people.
Ooh, I always wanted to chew on ginger spice.
Oh, you and me both, brother.
Well, speaking about chewing, we talked about it going in. Let's talk about it coming back out, Tim, because police are looking for Crapper Man in Florida.
Oh, no.
Crapper Man. Crestview, Florida. Police in Florida are on the search for a man they're calling Crapper Man. He was caught on a camera Tuesday morning defecating behind a business. A jewelry store employee in Crestview discovered the man's actions by nearly stepping in it when she was walking to her vehicle. Security footage shows a shirtless, bearded man dropping his pants and doing his business in the parking lot between two parked cars. Incidents like these have a negative effect on the quality of our life in our community, Police Chief Tony Taylor said. It's just downright shameful when people don't give a crap about their town. Mm-hmm. Well, I think the problem is this guy gave too much crap.
Oh, yeah.
Police say they searched for the suspect, but no one matching the description has been found. That's a clean getaway right there, Tim.
Oh,
good grief. That is just horrible. Hey, I love this story. We don't have many this week, but I want to cover this. This dude is fabulous. When stopped recently by police at a roadside checkpoint in Yishang, Hubei Province, one driver made the unconventional choice of acting like John Travolta on ecstasy during his sobriety test. The video has gone viral on Chinese social media of the man awkwardly dancing and gyrating while being asked by a police officer to blow into a breathalyzer to determine if he's capable of operating a motor vehicle safely. Surprisingly enough, he was. He was sober. The test showed that the man's blood alcohol concentration was 10 milligrams over 100 milliliters, which is below the legal limit. So he was allowed to drive on home with only a warning. And I'll tell you what, Tim, I'll include the link for the video so you can post it with today's show so people can actually go see this this fine dance moves this cat's got going on.
That sounds like a plan to me.
Did you have a job when you were a teenage boy, like when you were 12 or 13?
Oh, yes.
Yeah. What was your job?
When I was 12 or 13, I did a combination of babysitting, mowing lawns, and delivering the paper.
See, I worked under the table at a Chinese restaurant washing dishes. Okay. I was paid in cash, and it was a horrible transaction because it was Wing Hing's Chop Suey in Roselle, Tim, conveniently located. It's still there, but it's conveniently located right next to Page One Bookstore, which covered all of my comic books I ever needed. So wow. I would work, sweat, wash dishes, then carry my earnings over next door and buy comics and piss them away. So I never really made money on the deal, but it was a good trade-off. It was my way of kind of trading work for drugs. In my case, my drugs were comic books, Tim. But the 13-year-old we're about to talk about, well, he had a different kind of issue. 13-year-old driver. First of all, if you count that, Tim, that's, I think, 3 years younger than they're supposed to be. Caught with 25 pounds of meth after a traffic stop on I-70. This is in Mesa County, Colorado, when investigators pulled over a car for a traffic stop on Interstate 70 on Tuesday morning. They found a 13-year-old boy behind the wheel and 25 pounds of methamphetamine inside, the Mesa County Sheriff's Office said. A deputy with the Western Colorado Drug Task Force stopped the Dodge Avenger at Mile Point Post 13 West on Frutia. There were three people in the car, the 13-year-old driver, the 22-year-old German Michael Arolia, and 19-year-old Irene Michelle Arolia. Investigators say they're all from Los Angeles. So there's two adults, and they're idiots. They have the 13-year-old drive. Investigators say the three consented to a search of the vehicle, and that's when they found 23 packages containing a crystalline substance. All three suspects are facing felony charges, including manufacturing, possession, and distribution of a Schedule 1, Schedule 2 substance. The 13-year-old driver is facing additional charges for driving without a license and failing to drive in a designated lane. He's being held at the Grand Mesa Youth Services Center in Grand Junction. It's not his nationality. That's his name. German Michelle Arolia and Irene Michelle Arolia are being held in the Mesa County Detention Facility. See, the kid, if the kid's got a good defending attorney,
yeah,
he's just going to say, of course he was driving, and he was trying to get the attention of the police. That's why he was driving erratically, because he didn't want to be a part of this.
Right.
You see what
that's
I'm saying?
That's a great defense.
I'm just saying.
You, my friend, have been watching Matlock.
Yes. Yeah. Matlock would certainly help a 13-year-old meth-driving child out of trouble, I can tell, Tim. Good God. Yeah, Wing Hing's. I working there, I could not eat Chinese food until... I think it was around 2001.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah. And that was, I worked there in 79, 80, 81, somewhere in there. Really? So that's a lot of years, Tim. Yeah, because I watched what they did.
What is there that we should know about, or should we not know if we want to eat it?
Well, it was Wing Hing's Chop Suey in Roselle, Illinois, and I don't know if the same owners are there. So what I witnessed was a very crabby fry cook who would use his long spatula to just slap flies on the griddle when they were flying around annoying him and while he was mixing food.
Yeah.
I watched one day when they came around the corner too quick and knocked a huge, they had a whole rack full of egg rolls that they had rolled and were ready, and knocked them all onto the floor into a freshly swept pile of garbage that I just pulled. And I was informed to pick them up, wipe them off, and put them back on the trays.
Oh,
so I had problems eating Chinese food for many years, Tim. Many years. Yeah. So that was kind of my thing. And that's just a little gift from me to you. There are still people I meet at every convention, like the one we just came back from, Tim, who say they cannot eat at McDonald's because of my worm in the nugget story.
Oh, I don't blame them.
Yeah, so now I've just shed a little light on you. If you're in Roselle, steer clear of Wing Hing Chop Suey. Of course,
now,
that was 40 years ago, so I'm sure by now that, or not quite 40, 36 years ago, I'm sure by now there's probably new owners, but
yeah. Let me ask you this. Mm-hmm. Did you ever get the, after a long, hard week at work, did you ever get this from the parents? Hey, did you want to head down to your work and get something to eat? Maybe we can get a discount.
Thankfully, my parents did not like Chinese food.
Oh, good.
Or if they did, they never ate it. We never had Chinese food. Never.
Really?
No. Huh. We ate fancy stuff like fried bologna and beans, Tim.
Oh.
That was one of my favorites. You know, the comfort foods of grilled cheese dipped in hot tomato soup. Sorry, I'm still speaking a little English. I understand what happened to Madonna. You go over there, Tim, you just pick it up. Yeah. Tomato, potato, man. That's just the way it is.
Wow.
All right, a couple more dumb crimes for you. Have you ever played... You've played poker with me and other mm-hmm. friends, right? Have you ever played with like a loved one, like a girlfriend, boyfriend? I'm not here to judge you, Tim. Whoever. Have you ever played with somebody like that in a game of poker?
Yes, I have, Dave. Yeah.
Do you get more? See, I get when I play games like Pictionary and stuff, I don't like to be partnered up with my spouse or significant other because I'm very competitive and I know that about me. And I would much rather hate your wife than hate my wife.
Right.
So I like to try to pair up people, you know, so that if you beat me, hot damn, that's good, because then you're my wife and you beat me, and at least I'm married to a winner. If you're on my team and we lose, it's all her fault, and that's the only mm-hmm. way I can see it. So I try to avoid those kind of things, Tim. This guy might have wanted to call me before he decided to play poker with his wife. We're going to go to Florida, Tim. I know it's hard to believe, but we're going to Florida, Pasco County. Wesley Chapel, Florida. Pasco County deputies arrested a woman on Thursday for domestic battery on her husband after he refused to pay her the bet she had won on a card game. Deputies arrested Shaquanda Johnson, 34, of Wesley Chapel after she intentionally struck her husband. Johnson told deputies that she and her husband have been married for 7 years, lived together in the same house hold as a family. The two had made a bet on a card game they were playing. When Johnson beat her husband in the game, he refused to pay up. They got into an argument. Johnson followed her husband into the bedroom, picked up a white cell phone charger cord, put it around her husband's neck, according to the arrest affidavit. The report also notes that her husband, he didn't lose consciousness, so he was fighting it like a champ,
like a
video vamp. Her husband was able to get free and ran out of the back sliding door of the home. As he was preparing to leave in his car, she opened the door and jumped inside the vehicle. She hit him in the face in an attempt to keep him in the driveway. Her husband, and just for everybody out there, if you're trying to keep somebody closer to you, striking them in the face is usually counterproductive.
Yeah.
That's just a little tip from your pal Dave here at Darkness Radio and True Crime Tuesday. Her husband was able to get away and call the sheriff's office. Johnson was charged with domestic battery. Deputies did not say what the bet was or what the card game the couple was playing. I'm sure it was Uno. Uno has ruined many marriages and families, Tim.
Oh, boy, has it.
Yeah. Not in my world. I love Uno. Uno is my game-o. See what I did there?
I'm trying
to get these other two stories up here. And they just don't want to work for me. It's one of those
days. You know, a very cutthroat game of Go Fish also will break up marriages.
Ooh, Old Maid. How about that?
Yeah.
Scrabble.
Yeah,
Scrabble.
Right.
That's trouble right there. Naked man tried to climb through Treasure Island woman's window, Tim. This also takes place in Treasure Island, Florida, where a Treasure Island man was arrested for loitering and prowling after he tried to get into a stranger's home in the nude. Police responded to an incident at the 11,400 block of 1st Street East in Treasure Island. The 911 caller said she saw a naked man try to open her front window. The suspect, later identified as 38-year-old Eric Silverman, had already left the property by the time police arrived, but he was found moments later standing across the street and detained. So he wasn't even smart enough to get far enough away. And I bet he stands out like a sore thumb, or part of him does, at least, Tim. that's what made him... His capture so easy. Upon further questioning, do you think they had a little pair of cuffs just in case?
Oh, just a tiny one.
Upon further questioning, the victim confirmed the man in custody was the naked man at her window. Silverman told police he had been sleepwalking due to medication he was prescribed and taking. He said he didn't wake up until an officer brushed past his arm, according to an affidavit. The officer said that never happened. Police later found Silverman's clothes scattered across a yard nearby. Silverman was booked into the Pinellas County Jail. His bond was set to $250. That, I bet, is probably very real. Because I've heard of people taking some of these sleep aids. And just like some of sleep texted, some are like sleep eating, making 7-course meals in their sleep. And as we wrap up, Tim, let's talk about eating.
Okay.
Florida man. I know it's another Florida man story, Tim. He's been busy this week. Turns violent when restaurant employees say there's no free pizza. Lake Worth, Florida, a man grabbed a handful of rocks and threw them through a pizza display case after employees at a Florida restaurant told him they did not have any free food. According to the arrest report, the employees told deputies that James Dennison, age 56, of Lake Worth, yelled at a waitress Wednesday at Lake Worth Pizza when she said she couldn't give him a free slice of pizza. She told deputies she told him to leave, and employees escorted Dennison outside. When they reached the front door, Dennison grabbed a concrete planter and tried to throw it into the business located on South Dixie Highway, the report states. Another employee said he knocked it out of their hands. Dennison then threw rocks inside the pizzeria, breaking a pizza display case, according to the report. I've been hangry like that before, Tim.
Oh, you and me both.
He's being held at the Palm County County Jail for $14,000, and a judge ordered him not to go back to Lake Worth Pizza. So, where's the real justice in that case, Tim? You just heard it. No more pizza. You've been cut off, sir. All right, well, that's it for this week's Dumb Crimes, Stupid Criminals. I hope you enjoyed our look at the mob and interesting talk today with Charles Brandt. That was great. I can't wait to see that movie, The Irishman, Tim.
Oh, yeah.
Gonna be good. We'll be back next week with more True Crime Tuesday.
Well, there it is, your wrap up of Dumb Crimes and Stupid Criminals. We hope you enjoyed the interview as well with Charles Brandt, wrapping up the case of Hoffa and JFK and the real story behind The Irishman and what he believes happened with the ending. You got a better ending with Charles Brandt, I think, than you did if you actually saw the movie The Irishman. Want to take a moment to wish everybody a Merry Christmas or whatever it is you're celebrating at home, a Happy Holidays. And we want to thank you, the True Crime Tuesday subscriber, for contributing throughout the year to True Crime Tuesday. We truly do value your patronage here to this program. And Dave and I want to thank you so, so much for hanging in there with us throughout the year. And we love to entertain you. We love to give you the True Crime Tuesday interviews, the in-depth interviews, and entertain you there and bring you those stories. And we love to give you, of course, the Dumb Crimes and Stupid Criminals and give you a laugh there as well. And we'll continue to serve you throughout the coming 2020 year and on into the future. And please feel free to leave us feedback on the Patreon page or email us, Dave at DarknessRadio.com or Tim at DarknessRadio.com. We look forward to your feedback. We also look forward to your Dumb Crimes and Stupid Criminal stories. If you find one along the way that kind of tickles your fancy, please send it along to us and we'll include it in Dumb Crimes and Stupid Criminals. Again, I can't stress how much we truly do value you as a Patreon listener and a True Crime Tuesday listener. We really do value you and want to thank you for your patronage here on Patreon. For Dave Schrader, I'm Tim Dennis. Thank you again for listening to this special Christmas Eve Encore presentation. Have a very Merry Christmas, and we'll look forward to entertaining you again on New Year's Eve. Have a great Christmas, everybody.